celebration in the stadium. More on that anon. Just to mention, though, of tomorrow afternoon's Proms repeat. If you missed it when it was first broadcast live last Sunday, there's another chance to hear Mark Elder conducting the Aldeburgh World Orchestra, a brand new ensemble of young players brought together from every continent. In music by Benjamin Britten, his Sinfonia da Requiem, the Adagio from Mahler's unfinished 10th Symphony, and Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, plus a newly commissioned work by Charlotte Bray. So many memorable things in the concert, it's difficult to know what to highlight, but Elder made the Mahler seem more radical, more forward-looking than any other conductor I've heard. And in Stravinsky's Rite, the playing married precision and abandon in an unforgettable way. That's tomorrow afternoon here on Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. Just gone 7:30. Time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the second of today's Proms. Waiting for us there is Petroc Trelawney.
Hello, welcome back to the Proms. And this weekend, celebrating youth. Tonight, young musicians from all corners of the UK as the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain make their annual appearance at the Royal Albert Hall. Vasily Petrenko, the NYO's much-loved principal conductor, will lead Messiaen's Tarangalila Symphony. And there's the London premiere of a new work from the exciting young American composer, Nico Muhly. Well, the players of the NYO are in position on stage with leader Roberto Ruisi, a 16-year-old from Birmingham, who's going to direct the tuning should start.
This isn't a good time.
Well, it was tuning up, but just tuning up as written by Edgar Varèse, music that he wrote for his 1946 soundtrack to Carnegie Hall, a romantic comedy which included cameos by Bruno Walter, Fritz Reiner and Leopold Stokowski. Cameos tonight from bass players of the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, one of whose mobile phone rang. Maestro Vasily Petrenko took to the stage at the end, with audience participation as well from the crowds gathered here at the Royal Albert Hall. I'm asked to provide music to parody an orchestra tuning up. Varèse ran with the idea, creating that fantasy of his own and others' music, but it grew so epic that it was eventually dropped from the film. Well, we're live at the Proms this Saturday evening. Our weekend of youth that started with the Ulster Youth Orchestra of Northern Ireland this afternoon continues over the weekend and into Monday. And next, the London premiere of a BBC commission, a work from the high-profile young American composer Nico Muhly. It's called Gate. Gate, as in the rhythm of each step made by humans or animals.
Gate, I think, it's one of these fun, specific words. What it actually describes is a rhythm. It describes the motion of animals and people, obviously, and basically the rhythmic pattern of each step, how that repeats. You know, there are obviously sort of people who've been obsessing over this for years and years, and now, you know, with sort of high-definition video, you know, scientists and even casual observers, we have a much bigger access into what are these little tiny patterns that define how we move from point A to point B. I was trying to write a piece that sort of tapped into all those repetitive things that I myself am sort of obsessed with, but also that treated each family of instrument and each sort of section like a organism.
Nico Muhly very interested in the early stop-motion photographs of Edward Muybridge, some of which are reproduced in tonight's programme, which you can view online at bbc.co.uk/proms. Also the gait of horses. A few years back he was staying with a friend at St John's Wood in London when he had a dream about horses and woke to discover that they were outside the window. Horses from King's Troop Royal Horse Artillery used to be based in barracks in St John's Wood. Vasily Petrenko returns to the stage to conduct the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain in the London premiere of Gate by Nico Muhly. Gate by Nico Muley, played by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, conducted by Vasily Petrenko here at the BBC Proms. Nico Muley talks about how collaborative and multimedia projects have been key to his work over the past few years. It is, he says, a joy to get back to writing music for orchestra, without a strict dramatic or programmatic agenda. Vasily Petrenko returns to the platform. That cheer for William Morley, 18-year-old from Manchester, who's principal trumpeter in the National Youth Orchestra. Trombonist Andrew McCoy, and now the whole brass section on their feet, and here comes Nico Muley himself, bounding with great energy down to the stage, dressed like the orchestra, completely in black. Shake hands and makes a snappy, very dramatic bow to the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall. Raised in Providence, Long Island. Now in his early 30s, he, as a child, was a chorister in Providence's Episcopalian Church, then studied composition at the Juilliard School in New York. Christopher Rouse and John Corigliano were his principal mentors. Renaissance choral music and American minimalism, perhaps his two biggest influences. In his world, Gibbons and Bird sit very easily side by side with Steve Reich and John Adams. Vasily Petrenko, back on the platform, the St. Petersburg-born conductor, who is chief conductor of the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. And he's presided over a reinvigoration of that ensemble. Next September, he'll also take up the job of chief conductor of the Oslo Philharmonic. Well, welcome if you've just joined us. Radio 3 live at the Proms this Saturday evening, just gone 8:05. In 20 minutes' time, Olivier Messiaen's Tarangalila Symphony and the first Proms performance of a new work by Anna Meredith, for which a choreographer has been brought in. First, during the interval, we're bound for Paris for a tale of love which is not at all straightforward, as you'll discover in Some Bloom in Darkness by Simon Van Boy.
Since witnessing a violent incident at the railway station some months earlier, Sabine had not sketched a thing. He'd not sketched the pigeons that dripped from the ledges of the museum, nor had he shuffled through the museum, where he liked to sit and watch people rather than paintings. Sabine found a genuine pleasure in small things. He had lived with his mother in an unpretentious suburb of Paris until one day she died, and he thought it best to move and make a fresh start. Since then, he'd regressed into a shadow existence of adult life that seemed without beginning or end. Over the years, he had become quite skilled at sketching things, and as he aged, Sabine realized that he was like his sketches, that it was possible to be alive and not exist at the very same moment. The small apartment that Sabine found after his mother's death overlooked a fountain. Water bubbled through the mouth of a child. Sabine's evenings were quiet, but for the crackle of a fire in winter and the sound of his fingers turning the pages of books. However, not long after his mother died, a wild and ungovernable desire grew inside him. He hoped that by accident, perhaps on one of his long walks, he might meet a young lady of similar circumstance, with whom he could spend Sunday afternoons, and after work for cold platter suppers on the noisy Rue de Docteur Blanche. But this desire to meet a young lady, this sentiment, which drew him out to the cafes on the avenues, was accompanied by a powerful feeling of insincerity, and it made these desires slowly migrate, like a flock of rare birds. His life went back to normal, until one day, after almost 10 years, he witnessed a violent incident at the railway station, where he worked as a clerk. The desires suddenly returned, and soon enough, Sabine's eyes burned for the girl who stood in a shop window on his walk to work. She was very pretty, and Sabine assumed he had passed her many times before, but for some reason he had never noticed her. In addition to this new passion, Sabine caught himself doing odd things, like talking to birds and removing his hat whenever he passed statues in the gardens. For days, he held the image of the shop girl in his mind. Without constant vigilance, Sabine slipped into daydreams. After his mother died, his daydreams began to include voices, which he concluded were overheard conversations replayed by a decadent subconscious. Some daydreams wanted to swallow him up for good. In his top dresser drawer, Sabine kept the sketches he thought were acceptable. He possessed two. One of a door with elaborate rusting hinges, and the other of a cat he had seen peering up into the street from under a drain. Every Friday, the girl in the shop window would have a new outfit and be standing in a different way. Sabine often daydreamed while perched in his ticket box at the railway station. "Monsieur," the customers would cry, and Sabine would realize that it was a rainy afternoon and that he was not an Egyptian king, nor had he been sold into slavery by mistake. The girl in the shop window who preoccupied Sabine's thoughts was not really a girl, because she lacked a human heart. She was made of wood. From a distance, however, she may well have been mistaken for one. And from the way she peered into the street, through glass eyes, Sabine decided that she might as well be a girl, because he believed that girls peered longingly and had secrets. Sabine's small apartment room, where he would return each night after dispensing tickets at the station, wasn't big enough for two. But if she were able to come home with him, he supposed there was enough room for her to sit quietly, if she wished to. Before he began to notice the girl in the shop window, Sabine experienced the violent incident at the station. He had been up all night dreaming and had awakened exhausted. All morning, through the cold glass of his ticket window, Sabine was so drowsy that he'd barely been able to read the schedule, to which several minor adjustments were to be made owing to expected bad weather. Instead, with dreamy irreverence, the overtired Sabine began to sketch a woman who'd been sitting still, not very far from his booth. Sabine's hand glided across the paper, making the tiniest lines. Soon, they began to resemble a person, and with only a few strokes more, the image began to tremble before him, as though he had tricked some part of her soul into inhabiting the picture. He admired it, and folded it several times before dropping it into the waste paper basket, as if it were the wrapper from some tasteless baguette. When an arm of sunlight stretched through the glass roof of the station and engulfed the woman, Sabinet smiled, but his mouth showed no trace of it. At 11:45, a short, well-dressed man approached the woman, but he did not sit down. They began to chat, and Sabinet wondered what the man wanted, or whether he was an old acquaintance, relaying some story that had filled the void between their last meeting. In the same way a noise outside his room would release Sabinet from his dreams, so the short man clenched a fist and struck the woman squarely on the nose. He straightened his tie and looked as though he wanted to say something, but people were standing up, and he walked away quickly and quietly. The woman did not make a sound, but fought to control the stream of blood with a lacy handkerchief, which was soon crimson. People stared. An old man called for a gendarme. Sabinet began to shake. If he left the ticket office, the door was fixed so he wouldn't be able to get back in. If he asked her into the ticket box, there was a danger that someone would see, and he'd be dismissed. And Sabinet had never been dismissed from anything, nor had he ever spoken in anger or raised his voice. When the bleeding stopped, the woman's eyes were swollen from crying, and her nose was the colour of a plum. At 11:55, with the handkerchief still pressed to her face, she stood up and left the station. Sabinet strained to catch every last glimpse of her before she turned a corner and was gone. Despite the demands of an old woman with an ear trumpet, who wanted to know if she could leave Paris for a month but come back at the same time, Sabinet reached under his desk and fished the sketch of the woman from the waste paper basket. He slipped it into his pocket, as though evidence of a crime he had committed, but had no memory of. He explained to the old woman that she could leave on a train departing Paris at 11:58, but that it was impossible to return at the same time.
Impossible,
she affirmed, to the queue of people behind her, as though she'd always suspected it. By the time the girl in the shop window occupied a place in most of Sabinet's daydreams, it had been 2 weeks since the violent incident. Sabinet would often think he saw the woman at the station. Perhaps, by drawing her, he had bound their shadows together, like two nights without a day between them. When passing the girl in the shop window became something Sabinet looked forward to, he grew afraid and found another walk to the station through the city gardens. He didn't want to lose himself completely. Without her staring down at him from the window every morning and night, he could get some time to decide what to do. But Sabinet began to wake at irregular hours and think of her, like certain flowers in the park. Flowers that will only bloom in darkness. Sabinet had one friend, a man who lived in the apartment below. His name was Oncle. He was so large that he barely fit through the double doors of his own apartment. Sabinet had never seen him venture beyond the fountain. Oncle would sob bitterly in the night, as though his girth hid a swirling ocean of shame. Sabinet and Oncle exchanged cards at Christmas and often left notes for one another to acknowledge changes in the weather. Oncle wore loose, shiny gowns and velvet carpet slippers with a gold O stitched onto each one. His only request in the friendship was that Sabinet bring home spare or used train tickets, which Ankh liked to arrange very prettily in cloth-covered books. He knew the train timetables by heart, and it occurred to Sabinet that Ankh would have made a far superior ticket dispenser than he, if his friend were able to leave the apartment. One wet Sunday afternoon, after a lunch of cold meat and beer, Ankh puffed on a cigar and mulled over Sabinet's predicament, regarding the girl in the shop window. Finally, with rain upon the window like a thousand eyes, Ankh said, "Go into the shop, Sabinet, and politely inquire." The thought of entering the shop filled Sabinet with such fear that, following lunch, he went to bed and was carried away by dreams, like a leaf falling from a branch into a slow river. He awoke in the early hours of the morning, and though still dark, his room glowed with the snow that lay outside upon the streets and smoky roofs. Sabinet slid into his robe and crept to the window. The courtyard and the fountain below were in a deep sleep. Sabinet imagined bringing her back to his apartment. He imagined carrying her across the wedding cake snow of Paris, and then her face when she saw the fountain. The grey city was completely smothered by snow the next morning. The shop bell rang loudly as Sabinet entered, kicking snow off his shoes as he went. There were racks of dresses. There were feathered hats upon the walls like exotic birds. Inside the shop, there was no sound. As Sabinet made his way over to the window to see the girl, something appeared from between a dark rack of furs. Sabinet was not sure if it was a woman or a painted doll, but a small, trembling creature appeared before him. The woman's lips were blood red, and her skin was very white.
"Yes?"
She raised her cane at Sabinet.
"You've come to see the furs, have you?"
Coffee was brewing at the back of the shop.
"Well, do you see anything that pleases you?"
A thick paste of makeup moved when her mouth did. "I've been noticing the girl in the window on my way to work, madame."
"I'll bet you have. And you're not the first young man to politely inquire. Reminds you of someone, does she?"
The floor of his soul creaked, as though in the silence that followed, Sabinet's lips imparted the secrets of his loneliness, which even he didn't understand.
"Who? The girl?"
They both turned to the window and watched the snow as it found its place upon the earth.
"What is one to do? The city gardens are quite impassable at this time of year."
"Did you know there are flowers there that bloom in darkness?" Sabinet asked.
"But who goes to the gardens at night?"
Sabinet felt anger through his body like fire, but said, "I don't suppose anyone does." As he stepped into the street, he lost his footing and jarred his head against the ledge of the shop window. A few spots of blood appeared in the snow. Sabinet bent down in awe. His own blood lay before him. It had been inside him for almost 4 decades. It had passed through his body and lubricated his dreams. He knelt down as more drops collected in the snow, and then he fingered the soft gash on his head. His forehead turned numb from the pain, and every few steps
Sabine looked back at the red dots, at the eyes of his soul in the snow of the street. When he arrived at the ticket office, late for the first time in 13 years, the head ticket dispenser inspected him from above his spectacles. Sabine felt a line of blood warm his cheek.
"My dear boy, you've had a spill."
By evening, the station was almost deserted, and nearing supper time, a man approached Sabine's window and asked for a ticket to... anywhere.
Where is that exactly?
I can't say, the man said. Sabine thought of it that night in bed. At approximately 4 o'clock in the morning, Sabine sat up and went to the window. The moon was bright, but expressionless. He dressed and went outside. Then he walked to the city gardens. In moonlight, the statues moved their eyes and glowed. Sabine was not convinced that he was awake, but wondered why he'd never before swum through snow and moonlight, and why, after so many years of awkwardness, he felt as though he had found his home. And perhaps he was a character in the dream of Paris. Most of the plants in the garden balanced tiny burdens of snow on their tops. Although Sabine knew it was winter and he wouldn't see any in bloom, he realized he'd been mistaken. That it was not in darkness in which some flowers bloomed, but in moonlight. He scooped up some of the unbroken snow and chewed it. Then he laughed. How silly he had been to fall in love with a mannequin. Silly, he thought, but understandable, considering his circumstances. As the path widened, Sabine noticed someone sitting on a bench, and he stopped walking. He recognized her and recalled the image of her bloodied handkerchief and the spots of blood that followed her across the station to the platform. The eyes of her soul. Her presence convinced Sabine that he must be dreaming, because she was so white. When he got close, her eyes, which were wide open, didn't follow his movement. He reached out for her, but she did not move. He stroked her face with his fingers, including the nose, which was completely frozen. Crumbs of snow that had collected in her hair were intact. He knelt in the snow at her feet and remembered the sight of his own blood outside of the shop. He pulled himself up onto the bench. He reached around her with his arm and moved her closer. He squeezed her until he felt the bones beneath. Then he settled down and became quite still. He found the drawing of her in his jacket pocket and unfolded it. Then he put his arm around her again and wished that everyone he'd ever met was able to see him. It was some time before they were moved.
Toby Jones was reading Some Bloom in Darkness by Simon Fanboy. The producer was Duncan Minchell. Well, they're not quite ready for us yet back at the Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, so with the majority of it given over to the musical spectacle that is Messiaen's Turangalila Symphony, for the moment something of his on a smaller scale. It's his song La Fiancée Perdue, The Lost Fiancée. It's a tribute to and a prayer for Messiaen's mother, who'd died a year or two before he wrote the song. The singer is Susan Graham and the pianist Malcolm Martineau.
Thank you.
La Fiancée Perdue by Olivier Messiaen. And the singer was Susan Graham, the pianist Malcolm Martineau. Well, I'm happy to say we can now go back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's BBC Prom, so I'll hand you back to Petroc Trelawney.
Jonathan, thank you very much. As you might imagine, when it's an orchestra of 165 people on stage, that's twice the size of many of the symphony orchestras that perform here at the Proms. It takes a bit of time to get the stage reset during the interval. However, we are now ready to go. The players of the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain filing back into position on the Royal Albert Hall stage. This our weekend of youth at the Proms. Six Welsh youth choirs will join the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and National Youth Orchestra of Wales for Bernstein's Mass on Monday night. And tomorrow there are appearances by the National Youth Choir and the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland. Full details at bbc.co.uk/proms. Tonight then, the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, who made their first Proms appearance in 1955. They've appeared annually since 1979. And next this evening, they're going to perform Olivier Messiaen's extraordinary, astounding Tarangalila Symphony with its solo roles for En Martineau and piano. Well, earlier we discussed the work that's partly inspired by the Tristan and Isolde myth with two musicians in the NYO and the orchestra's principal conductor, Vasily Petrenko.
It's a very difficult piece for everybody, including conductor. And it's also quite difficult for understanding, because you need to understand that the piece about love and the piece about meditation, the piece about this cosmic, spacious feeling of love, not only the earthy one. And the piece was written by Messiaen at the time when he finally found probably the first true love of his life, is Yvonne Loriot. And to give all this information to the kids and to absorb this information is quite a big task, alongside with enormous technical difficulties of the piece.
I think he connects with the piece himself really well. He understands all its ins and outs and is emotionally involved, and it just rubs off on the orchestra, really.
He uses just things that we could relate to kind of get us to understand what Messiaen wanted, like the love theme and everything. We've had a lot of laughs about that. I think he does. I don't know if someone does a really good impression of him, but it's not me. But he really helps us to understand in ways that we can understand.
Of course, you need to know Tristan and Isolde. You need to understand all this myth and all this story and all the tensions between must and need in your private life, and all the tensions between the power of love and power of society and a power of your debt to the society. And I believe that in many ways this is autobiographical piece by Messiaen about how he felt at that point.
Vasily Petrenko, and we also heard from National Youth Orchestra violinist Lily Whitehurst and oboist Rhys Webster. Well, the En Martineau this evening will be played by Cynthia Miller, who studied the instrument in France with Jean Loriot, Messiaen's sister-in-law. And the pianist, that wonderful artist and ever-hungry musical collaborator, Joanna McGregor. So we await their arrival here on the platform of the Royal Albert Hall to join the vast forces of the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. And here they come. Joanna McGregor, piano, Cynthia Miller on Martineau, and Vasily Petrenko to conduct the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain in Olivier Messiaen's Tarangalila Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. What a sight at the end of that. 100 bows triumphantly held high by the string players of the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. The sound of the brass section, the woodwind, filling the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. 165 of them in all on their feet now after that performance of Olivier Messiaen's Taranga Lila Symphony. Vasily Petrenko, the conductor. Cynthia Miller playing on martineau. Joanna McGregor, piano. Messiaen writing in the second half of the 1940s, and he was feeling a great sense of exhilaration, as we hear in the music, at the very fact that he'd survived his captivity during the war. He'd been captured by the Germans in May 1940, not long after being called up for duty as a medical orderly. Well, the vibrations coming through the floor of the Royal Albert Hall are more forceful than I've ever experienced before. Place filled tonight with former graduates of the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, now perhaps too old to be taking part. And then there are dozens of siblings here this evening cheering on their brothers and sisters, not to mention proud parents. Brass section on their feet, trumpeters, horn players. Into the woodwind, David Wong, principal clarinetist. Luke O'Toole, 18-year-old from Bursko, principal flautist. The whole woodwind section now on their feet. Vasily Petrenko shakes hands with Roberto Ruisi, a 16-year-old lad from Birmingham, who is leader of the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. Now he embraces Cynthia Miller. This is the third time the National Youth Orchestra have played Taranga Lila here at the Proms. Each time Cynthia Miller played on martineau. Third appearance tonight. Previously conducted by Mark Elder in 1986 and Sandra Davis in 2001. Well, much movement on stage now because the concert isn't over yet. Instruments being put down because we're going to be hearing a piece called Hands Free by Anna Meredith, in which the orchestra become 165 strong team of equals. Hands free because instruments are the one thing that they will not be holding. Vasily Petrenko, though, before that, is back on stage for another bow. Can only just about make him out amongst the forces on stage. He's climbed onto the podium now, using his height. He claps the orchestra here. Earlier on, he told them to go out there, enjoy it, not play too loud. Remember, they were making music. Principal element tonight was their enjoyment. Well, body percussion, singing, beatboxing, that's a sort of vocal percussion, the noises we're going to hear. Hands Free, a work that the NYO have performed at various locations as a flash mob. This is one of the PRS for Music Foundation's New Music 2012 commissions for the Cultural Olympiad. Various players filing back on. The double bass players, for example, had to take their instruments off stage to create the space for the choreography involved in Anna Meredith's piece, getting its London premiere this evening. Well, that sounded amazing, and I have to say looked pretty spectacular as well. Every player in the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain had their hands in the air at the end of that. Hands free by Anna Meredith, getting its London premiere here at the Proms. One of the PRS for Music Foundation's New Music 2012 commissions for the Cultural Olympiad. Here comes Anna Meredith, dressed in a wonderful orange number, with her David Ogle, who is movement tutor of the National Youth Orchestra, choreographer of Hands Free. I have to say, from the physicality that we saw on stage then, once these players grow too old for the National Youth Orchestra, I think Team GB should probably take a look at them. Well, if you're a young musician and tonight's concert has inspired you to think about the NYO, well, you have to be under 18 to be able to play an orchestral instrument to at least grade 8 with distinction. You don't need to have passed the exams, but you have to be able to play the instrument that well. Must not be studying music full-time and be either a British citizen or resident or student in the British Isles. If you meet all those criteria, you get to audition. Details from nyo.org.uk. I tell you what, you really are going to want to see Anna Meredith's piece, having heard it. And you will be able to. It's going to be on BBC 4 on the 23rd of August. Put that date in your diary. 23rd of August, BBC 4. Well, as Vasily Petrenko said to the orchestra this afternoon, this is the last time they'll get to perform together in this setup. Lots of musicians will be saying goodbye now. They've crossed the age threshold, moving out in the world to continue their lives, whether they continue making music as amateurs or indeed as professionals. Others will be back next year when the National Youth Orchestra return. And tomorrow, our Festival of Youth continues here at the Proms. Jonathan will tell us more about that in a moment, but with hugs and a few tears as well on the stage here at the Proms, we reach the end of this extraordinary concert by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. Back to Broadcasting House, back to Jonathan Swain.
Petroc, thank you very much. A prom with a difference. Petroc Trelawney with tonight's live prom. And along with the iPlayer, there's another chance to hear that prom broadcast here on BBC Radio 3 on Tuesday week at 2 in the afternoon. As for more live proms, well, another two of them tomorrow from the Royal Albert Hall. The first is a choral prom bringing together singers young and old, children and adults, professionals and amateurs, over 600 voices together with a choir for hearing impaired children. David Hill conducts them in The Angry Planet, Bob Chilcott's new cantata exploring humanity's complex and often destructive relationship with the natural world. And there's also Flame by Ben Parry, taking the image of the Olympic torch as a beacon of light, life and understanding in the world. That prom begins at 4:30 here on Radio 3. And as Petroc was saying, we're back at the Albert Hall tomorrow night, keeping the focus on Britain's musical youth. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, joined by the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland and Nicola Benedetti, in a programme of showpieces: Bruch's Scottish Fantasy, Wagner's Master Singers Overture, Respighi's Pines of Rome, and Richard Strauss's Don Juan. That's tomorrow night at 7:30, live here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. Well, in 3 minutes or so tonight, post-prom music and poetry from emerging young artists in Proms Plus. Petroc will be back to introduce that at 10:15. For the moment, mezzo Susan Graham and pianist Malcolm Martineau in A Song of April by Georges Bizet. Tu côté des lumières. Chanson d'Avril, Song of April, by Bizet, the mezzo there, Susan Graham, and the pianist Malcolm Martineau. This is BBC Radio 3. It's a 10:15. Well, next tonight, another selection of music and poetry from a Proms Plus event in the Elgar Room at the Royal Albert Hall. This took place after last Saturday night's prom concert, and it's introduced once again by Petroc Trelawney.
Hello, welcome to the Elgar Room at the Royal Albert Hall, the Proms Salon for late night happenings. Tonight we welcome Matt Robinson, a fantastic pianist from Wakefield who is here with his quartet. But to begin, a poet from Jamaica whose most recent collection, A Light Song of Light, was published by Carcanet Press. He's also the editor of Carcanet's anthology of new Caribbean poetry. Would you please welcome Kai Miller?
I'll start with this, some definitions for song. The speech of birds, as in bird song, but with exceptions. Pigeons do not sing, vultures do not sing. A bargain or a very small sum, as in he bought it for a song. Think what we could purchase with songs thrown across the counter and landing more softly than coins, perhaps then the origin of the expression to sing for your supper. The troubled sound that escapes from a woman's mouth while she dreams of fire, also any sound that escapes, also anything that escapes, a passage out, the fling up of hands, a prison break is a song. The parting of the Red Sea was a song. In Israel, there are many songs, but we needed 6 million more. Across the Atlantic, there are many songs, but there should have been 10 million more. Song was a state during the Eastern Zhou spring and autumn period, 770 to 476 BC. Its capital was Shangku. Anything that climbs is a song. Vines are a song. My father, 70 years old at the top of the Aki tree, is a song. All planes are songs. Song was a low-cost airline operated by Delta. Tourists were flown by song to Florida. Song's last flight was on the 30th of April, 2006. All that pleases the heart, all that pleases the ear, the final measure of joy when we have lost song, we have lost everything. A common surname in Korea, often transliterated as Sung. What would it mean if your name was Song? Song is the third and final album of Lullaby for the Working Class. It was released on the 19th of October, 1999. Songs often refer to songs as in, he shall encompass me with a song, sing unto the Lord a new song, sing a song of sixpence, but sing a song, sing a song.
Thank you.
All right, just one poem to close. I think actually I'll not so much read, I'll try to remember this. The poem is called A Prayer for the Unflummoxed Beaver. A prayer for the unflummoxed beaver, so unmoved by the boat's slow approach, the boat drifting across the flat green acres of water. A prayer for these acres of water, which in the soft light seem firm. The squirrels, however, are never fooled or taken in. A prayer for the squirrels and their unknowable but perfect paths. See how they run across the twisting highway of cedars, but never crash. A prayer for the cedars and their dead knees rising from the water like tombstones. For the cedar balls that break when you touch them and stain your fingers yellow, that release from their tiny bellies the smell of old churches, of something holy. A prayer for the holy alligators. You owe them that at least. For just last night when you thought of Hannah, you asked them to pray with you, knowing that the prayers of alligators are potent. At night, the grass is full of their red eyes. A prayer for the grass which they divide in the shape of a never-ending S. You lean over to pull some into the boat. In Burma, you are told it is called kanapaw and can be cooked with salt and oil. A prayer for the languages we know this landscape by. For the French, as spoken by fat fishermen, the fat fishermen who admit to the water, we all dying, you understand, savant? A prayer for the dying that will come to all of us, but may it come soft as a boat drifting across the bayou. May it find us unrattled and as unflummoxed as the beaver.
Thank you.
Ways and Means by the Matt Robinson Quartet, and before it they played Failing Lights with poetry from Kai Miller. Those were highlights from the Proms Plus event recorded at the Elgar Room in the Royal Albert Hall last Saturday evening. And there'll be more from the late night Proms events next Tuesday evening at 10:30. Fancy a challenge? Ian McMillan has one for you.
Words and music go rather well together, and great music often inspires great words. Radio 3 has proved that over the years. There's no finer inspiration than the 2012 BBC Proms season, and this year we're inviting you to take part in the 2012 BBC Proms Poetry Competition. All you have to do is write a poem inspired by any piece of music in this year's season. There are categories for both children and adults, and the winners will have their poems performed at a Proms Plus event and then broadcast on BBC Radio 3. All the details, including the terms and conditions, are online. Type BBC Proms Poetry into your search engine or click through from the Radio 3 homepage. The deadline is Friday the 10th of August, so get listening and get scribbling, or get writing neatly.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10:30, and next this evening, Here and Now, presented by Robert Warby.
Hello, tonight we have music from the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ilan Volkov, recorded in April, that was part of a Richard Ayres composer focus, also featuring music by Marco Nico Dijavic and Lawrence Crane. Plus the Here and Now 50, Igor by Giacinto Scelsi. Now, there may well be some people who would argue that the likes of Ayres, Crane and Nico Dijavic do not compose new music. Here's Ilan Volkov.
It's funny, you know, one of the persons that is playing in the orchestra this week said 30 years ago we couldn't have done this concert. So basically it's not this approach of new music. And I had a concert with Ensemble Modern. There was quite a well-known German composer in the audience, quite a big name in new music in Germany. And he said after the concert, there was only one piece that was really new music. And of course, he meant, you know, Marc-André, which I really liked the piece. But the other pieces were like popular, coming from another angle completely. And so what's great about what Richard does, and also what Lawrence and Marco, I think that they agree that it's okay to use tonality. It's okay to use rhythms that are simple. And it does not mean that your music is simple.
The first piece is GHB, Tanz Aggregat, by Marco Nico Dijavic. GHB are the German note names for G, B natural and B flat. But GHB is also, apparently, the name of a recreational drug popular in the techno music scene. Here's Ilan Volkov again.
It has a kind of drive to the piece. It's funny because it's not a clubby sort of piece. It's not a house piece. It's very American in many ways, especially the ending. And it's very much built in blocks. So like in techno or house where, you know, you've got a few bars of one section and then another few bars with orchestration that's kind of changing. So I think you can hear that in this piece. But actually, you know, the folk elements in it, which are very hidden, but you can sense them. And also a lot of different rhythms that he throws in there. That's why I kind of really like the piece, because it's very Western, in a sense, like an American Boston Pops piece. But you can see that it's written from another angle. It's a kind of dance piece, and it's very popular kind of in writing. Very simple structure, it's very short, and it's, you know, it's obviously kind of a fun piece for listeners and orchestra, like an opener.
Thank you.
GHB, Tanz Aggregat by Marco Niko Dijavic. It was performed by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ellen Volkoff. The next two composers we're here tonight are Lawrence Crane and Richard Ayres, who are not afraid to keep music uncomplicated, lucid and straightforward. Does that make it sound dated, obsolete and perhaps somewhat limited? Not at all, says Ellen Volkoff.
You don't sense that it's old in any way. It sounds completely fresh. Because I think Richard and Lawrence, I think, have a really beautiful way of looking in a new, fresh way on tonality and rhythms. And so I find both composers are doing something very original, very much unlike Steve Reich or Philip Glass. I mean, it's a completely different way of looking at it. And of course, Richard, you know, he's got a big influence from Louis Andriessen in that scene.
The Hague scene.
Yeah, but also he's got a huge influence from Gerald Barry and Christopher Fox and people like that. So it's a mixture of the English and European and a very original voice. I mean, I think with Richard's music, you can really sense that there's nothing like it. And I think there was a whole movement that kind of gradually allowed this to grow. I mean, from Terry Riley to Steve Reich. And I think that in Europe, there is a very interesting way that that happened. I mean, you could see that in kind of early 70s, late 60s, Danish music, Per Norgard and other composers, and of course Hans Abrahamsen, and they really use tonality in a new way and they are not afraid of it. You know, you're allowed to put it in any context. It's not the 50s anymore where, God forbid, we'll have a fifth there and a major third, forget it, you know. This also, of course, it's a lot of politics involved in this. It's a huge history that is attached to these issues. But I think now it's sort of irrelevant because I think if you're composing and you're using what's available in an interesting way, it comes out. So I think it's less of a ideological fight. Of course, in Germany, it's still, you know, I know Richard's music in Germany sometimes is received very badly. They're just not interested. When I say they, I mean the new music kind of establishments or festivals.
Is that something to do with humor as well?
Yeah. That's actually interesting. Humor, the way Richard uses it, it's very him. You know, there's nobody else that does that.
It's also very English.
Yeah. And I mean, Benedict Mason uses that. He goes there sometimes. And there's other composers who do it. But it can throw people and think, this is not serious. They can think, and it's the best thing, you know, when you're musicians, to say to the other thing, this is not serious. This is not Brahms. This is not Mahler. It's just frivolous. It's just like Satie or something. You know, so it goes back to this, you know, how much you're allowed to do something that's funny, how much you're allowed to do something that's totally absurd. You know, it's the distance between like utter depression and like ecstatic humor is very close in this music.
Tonight's conductor, Ellen Volkoff. And here's Lawrence Crane. I asked him in what sense his West Sussex folk material was based on actual folk material.
In no sense at all. The origin of the title is a short piano piece called Stenning that I wrote earlier in the year that I wrote the orchestral piece, 2006. And I needed something to start my orchestral piece with. I decided to use this material from Stenning. Stenning is a small town in West Sussex where the piece was first played.
So why do you refer to folk material?
Well, maybe I had the mistaken idea that I could create a sort of folk music of my own for the people of West Sussex. But of course, when you hear it, the piece, you'll see how much I failed in that respect.
Now, in your programme notes, you mentioned this quote from the American artist Jasper Johns, who said, take an object, do something to it, do something else to it, do something else to it. What is the object that you've taken and what have you done to it?
Well, there are sort of two objects, really, in the piece. There's one that goes up and then one that goes down by step. The piece is actually entirely constructed of major triads in root position. I've composed a few pieces like this, which focus almost entirely on the major triad. In this piece, I also, you know, stack major triads on top of each other or put them in bitonal configurations. But essentially, the whole thing is made out of major triads. So you could say that the object is the major triad.
It's a major triad. Now, your music is very direct and appears to have very straightforward structures, engaged with very straightforward structures. We're able to hear clearly exactly what is going on, and nothing is hidden at all. There are no secrets.
I think I like things to be clear and focused and stripped away of anything unnecessary.
No decoration.
No decoration at all. But this is one piece that, and together with some of my large ensemble pieces, that I've obviously very interested in colour. Obviously, you know, with the orchestra you have all the instruments, but still very few notes to go around, as far as I'm concerned. So I use colour as a structural resource.